this is what information and education is what Progressive Radio Network production. Really important. Ah, we got the music still playing. There we go. Anyhow, welcome to Warrior Connection again. Hey, we just had September 11th. A lot of memories came back. For most have listened to the show before, I was totally involved with that. We trained the New York Police and Fire Emergency Services Unit that went into the World Trade Center when it was blowing up deliberately and willfully. You know, and obviously a missile hit the Pentagon and all that stuff. It's a nightmare, but hey, the evidence is out there. Gary did an incredible program on this last Sunday dealing with all that. He had the experts on there. Go back to the archives and listen to it. Today we're going to continue on thriving. As we continue, we found out more and more. There's more individuals that have figured out how do they deal with the aftermath of war. How do they deal with the aftermath of PTSD? And boy, we have found a gem, ladies and gentlemen. Ray, you want to take over and introduce our guest, please?
Thank you, Doug. And I spoke at a reboot organization meeting for post-traumatic stress victims at Camp Lejeune, and while speaking there, they had a lot of people working there, and I met a couple. His name is Roy, and his wife Pam, and their last name is Fish. But they came up to me and they said, "Look, we're trying to help veterans." He was a former Marine himself. And he's really working hard trying to work on his PTSD, but also reaching out to other ones. And he's become a good friend of mine and Doug's also. And his name is Roy Fish. And Roy, if you will, just introduce yourself and let us know what you're doing.
Yeah, I spent about 19 years in the Marine Corps before I was medically retired due to injuries I sustained in combat in Afghanistan. And so, you know, just like everybody else, I came back from my last tour with PTSD and anxiety and depression and a misunderstanding of what was going on and how do you go from sustained combat to living a normal life and being a husband and a father and a friend and a functioning member of society. And I did, you know, what most guys do. You turn to alcohol, you turn to drugs, you turn to sex, you turn to women, you turn to pornography. I mean, you know, whatever it is that you know, your personal go-to is, it doesn't matter. It's all bad stuff. What the world tells you will fix the problem. And for a long time, I was kind of lost, and I found myself in a situation where many combat vets find themselves. When I had a pistol in my hand and contemplating suicide, and I'm sure you're aware, Ray, I think we've had a conversation about it, that 22 veterans a day are committing suicide right now, and those numbers are disputed. There's probably more. And I was, you know, on the way to becoming another statistic, and in the midst of that decision, basically, Christ found me in that moment, and I said, you know what? Okay, God, I'm going to give you an opportunity to redeem this. And I went, you know, all in for God. And one of the things that he revealed to me is that something that I've been doing my entire life was building furniture and doing woodwork and things like that. And what I discovered is, as I was out in my wood shop working, is that, you know, I was gaining a lot of healing, and it was very therapeutic being out there, just being alone, being with the saws, you know, being with the wood. It was just a very healing environment for me. So I thought, you know, if this is good for me, it might be good for other combat vets. So I started reaching out to other guys who I knew were struggling, and brought them over, and we started, you know, teaching them how to build things. And I think a lot of guys get into a place where, you know, especially in terms of the decision to commit suicide in the aftermath of combat, where they feel like everything in my life that I've touched, I've destroyed. I've destroyed my career. I've destroyed my marriage. I've destroyed my relationship with my children and my friends. And they feel like they just have nothing, you know, else to live for. So they make that decision to take their own life. And so in terms of woodworking, I bring these guys in, and I take them, and I say, hey, we're going to take this piece of wood that, is just a piece of wood existing on the earth right now, and we're going to turn it into something. And at the end of the day, or end of the week, or ever how long it takes us to build whatever it is we're building, I can put that tangible item in their hand and say, look, not everything you touch is destroyed because you just created something. And
that's true.
Though we begin to build that relationship and show them that their life does have worth and that, you know, you can heal from it. And being in the shop and being around other combat veterans is healing all in itself. I had a guy tell me one day, he goes, you know what? I'm just happy to be in a place where I don't have to explain to somebody what PTSD is. Because everybody that, you know, it's like, we don't even have to talk about it. Because everybody's like, I know you're combat blood and guts. I don't need to hear the details. You know, I got combat blood and guts, and you don't need to hear my details. So it's just a place where guys can come and just breathe out for once and not be stressed out, not be anxious, not be angry, and do something. So then to take that one step further, we donate a lot of the furniture that we build to needy families. If they, you know, foster families need beds for the kids, or if they need chairs, or if they need a table to eat on, you know, we'll build that. And so now this guy not only feels like, man, I just created something, but guess what? Now my life even means more because something I did is now blessing someone else. I'm there's a meaning behind what I'm doing. And then the last piece of what we do is those guys that gave the ultimate sacrifice and died in combat, they can no longer bless anyone on this earth because they've gone to see our Father, Jesus Christ. And so what we do is we take a name off of the list of Marine, soldier, sailor, airman, it doesn't matter, the branch of service, and we literally burn the name, rank, and birth date and death date into that piece of furniture. And when we deliver it to whoever is going to be blessed by it, we bring the bio of that person and a picture of that person, and we explain to them who they are so that for the rest of that furniture's life, every time somebody sits down at that table to eat dinner or lunch or breakfast or sits down in that chair, they go, who is Staff Sergeant John Smith? And they can say, John Smith was this guy, and he died in Afghanistan in 2013, whatever the story is behind him, and they can tell that story. So then that combat veteran who gave all lives and is honored through that piece of furniture for the existence of that piece of furniture, and his story continues to be told.
That's incredible. I know Doug was a Vietnam veteran and Gulf War veteran, and I was a Vietnam veteran, and so we have three different wars right here. And I think all of us deal with the same things of moral injury. We come back with physical and sometimes, well, most of the time, emotional problems. And I can resonate with what you're saying, or it resonates with me, as far as when you come back and you want to create something good, or you want to do something good to maybe make yourself feel better. And I think a lot of veterans do exactly what you did. Doug, if you will, tell them how you coped when you came back home.
Well, when I came back from Vietnam, I mean, it's really weird because this is the anniversary, right, this last week. I mean, right. I got back, got out September 7th of 1971. That's after 2 years in Vietnam. And I got home, and I drove all the way from Westover Air Force Base all the way back here to Illinois in one solid trip. I got home about, 2 or 3 in the morning, having left there at 9 or 10 in the morning, and got up and everything else, went and had some fun with my cousin and my aunt. And then on Friday, 4 days later, I started college at West Illinois University. I wasn't a human being. I didn't have real clothes. All I had was combat, junk. I still smell because I hadn't been out of the military long enough to, even change my diapers. And I went right back into college right immediately. And then we did all the stuff. And as Ray knows, I mean, the first time I got, I was probably a junior in college. I got recalled to active duty again. This is in 74. And I just spent the summer on active duty, got out again. But it was so strange because when I came back from Vietnam, I had been in my last combat mission, from the time I had my last combat mission, active combat mission, until I was sitting back home in a local VFW for a 25th wedding anniversary of my parents' best friends, who was my best friend's parents. It was less than 48 hours, I think. It was actually just over 24, maybe 30 hours. I mean, I'm not sure what happened. Roy, when you came back from Afghanistan or Iraq, I mean, how did you get back, or what happened, and how much time evolved, or what was going on?
Yeah, it's funny to hear you describe your experience like that, because I had a very similar experience. I was fighting one day on a patrol. We were on an airplane at Camp Leatherneck in Afghanistan in Helmand Province. The next day, we flew to an Air Force base in Kyrgyzstan. We were there for 24 hours. We got on another plane, and 16 hours later, I was landed in Cherry Point, North Carolina, and my wife and daughter were standing there waiting for me. So in basically about 48 hours, I guess, would be the total trip. I went from life or death and kill or be killed to, and the funny part was I left my daughter when she was 20 days old, and I came back a year later to, you know, a one-year-old who I didn't know, and she didn't know me. And so it's a weird feeling stepping off the plane and putting a little girl in your hands that's yours, but it's really not yours, and you don't know what to do with it. I'd spent a year in combat, not picking anybody up or picking anything up for fear it was going to blow up. And now all of a sudden I have this little baby in my hands, and she, you know, these wide eyes are looking at me like, who is this scary guy? And I'm looking at her like, what is this thing in my hands? And so, yeah, there was no transition. And, you know, you go home, and it's euphoric because you're home, but you wake up the next day, and you're just, you know, and I don't have to, you know, explain it to either one of you guys, but in combat, you get down to the basics of humanity, and you're almost an animal, because you just live on your animal instincts of kill or be killed. And then all of a sudden, I'm supposed to be a loving, hugging, kissing daddy and a husband. And how do you do that? You know, I don't know how you do that. I don't know how anybody does it. I've been through it and still don't know how to do it.
I think it's amazing. And I guess the way I explain it a lot of times when I'm talking, like at Camp Lejeune and some of these classes that I'm blessed to teach, I try to explain it. I've grown up in a place called Disney World, and where colors and light and laughter and noise and people driving cars and going to 30 different restaurants and all these things, that's America. And then we're sent into a third world country where they see black and white, and, you know, you just... In the jungles, we couldn't even raise your voice, really. Everything had to be, you know, hushed down. You couldn't use aftershave. You couldn't use anything that gave off an odor because the enemy would ambush you. And then when you spend time in a place where people were killing each other and you're living in black and white, life and death, you come back to Disney World and you don't fit in. I mean, you're still in black and white mode. And I can understand completely what you're saying about it's such a culture shock, maybe, that it's just hard for a lot of people to even imagine, but it's true. So yeah. I think we all...
I try to explain it to people like this. I say, imagine in your house, if you go to your breaker box and you flip a switch in your breaker box and you're trying to get the lights in your kitchen to go off, but the lights in the living room go off as well, you know. And the reason why that happens is because those two rooms are on the same circuit. So in combat, you have to take that switch that, you know, you think of your in terms of emotions, you know, your compassion, your love, your happiness, your... any good emotions are all kind of on the same circuit. So in order to, you know, wake up every day and go out into that environment and just have to make the decision between life and death and be in constant fear of your own life and the lives of your Marines or soldiers that are under you or beside you or above you for any matter, you switch all that off and you just live. You live this you know, this black and white, like I said, this black and white existence, day in, day out, day in, day out, day in, day out. And then the problem is it's easy to shut it all off, but it's very hard to then turn it all back on. And I think that God inherently builds us in a way that the only emotion not attached to that circuit is anger, because anger keeps us alive. It's easy in a combat situation to just get angry, and the anger sustains you, and it drives you forward and you know, allows you to fight the next day or the next battle. So when you come home, the only emotion you know how to show is anger, because that's the only one that's working. And, you know, a lot of times the lack of emotion is part of the you know, the hard part too. You know, I want to have compassion, I want to have love, I want to experience all those things with my wife and my daughter and my family, but the fact that I just can't possibly muster up a loving, happy feeling makes me even more angry. So then I just revert back to anger, and you know, you wonder why. You know, a lot of people wonder, you know, why, you know, why are all these combat veterans, you know, all this guy wants to do is be angry all the time. And then, you know, you go to the hospital or the VA, and the answer 9 times out of 10 is, here, take these pills. No, take these pills. All right, take 2 of these pills. And, you know, it's like, wait a minute, man, do I really want to keep taking all these pills? I'm just not sure about all this. And, you know, so then when do you get down to the root of it? When do you get to the core of the problem and really start to identify what it is? And I think it's amazing that Ray, me and you met, and I started, you know, hearing some of your stories and how you coped and the things that you did when you came back, and I'm sure Doug is the same way. And you guys, you know, I always tell the Marines today that I work with that, you know, we have it way better. Even though there are some areas that still need some work, we have it way better than the guys that came back from Vietnam, because not only were you dealing with the same internal stuff that I deal with every day, you were dealing with, you know, public distrust and hatred and all the things that happened, you know, on the end of the Vietnam War. But you guys figured it out pretty quick. You know, you figured out that the VA wasn't going to be there for you as much as you needed them. You figured out that society wasn't going to be there for you. You know, the corporate America wasn't going to be there for you. And you guys banded together, and you helped each other. And that you had to rely on each other at home, just like you did in the jungles of Vietnam. And, you know, my generation have learned a great lesson from you guys. And that's what our company, Triple H, is all about. We have decided that, you know what, just like the guys coming back from Vietnam had to step up and stand tall with each other and help each other, nobody's going to help us except us. And we have taken the model that you guys laid out in front of us, and we're just picking up the ball, and we're continuing to run with it. And I want to say, from my generation to your generation, thank you very much for blazing that trail for us, both to make it very much easier, because society looks at us completely different than you guys were treated when you came back. With a lot more respect and admiration for what we had to do, but not only that, but just the you know, the groundwork you guys laid and the ideas and the realization that, hey guys, you got to step up and you got to take care of yourselves, because nobody's going to do it for you.
You know, we talked about this on this radio program ad nauseum, because Roy, you're not aware, but we lost a co-host on our show to suicide. And that was a year ago. And by the way, Tammy Lyons wants to hold a memorial dinner banquet and service in Missouri, at Branson, Missouri, at the Military Museum there on September 30th. So anybody out there listening, if you're in the region, get in contact with us. We'll have more information. But that's what Tammy Lyons wants to do right now. I talked to her yesterday on the telephone again. You know, it's so strange, because the public attitude from when we went to Vietnam, and that war was just based on lies, and the attitudes toward the military, and then the attitudes toward the military today, and yet so many in the military and all of us that were involved, we understand that the current wars are based on lies.
Yes.
And then what you end up with, and I think we've talked about the ad nauseum, it bothers me beyond comprehension, I know it bothers Ray, is this deep moral injury because you're dealing with the subconscious mind that has a realization of what it was all about and what happened. Then you're dealing with a conscious mind that you have to go along with nonsense in order to belong and be part of something that you know was bigger than you but still wrong. And so many Vietnam vets, as a consequence, haven't come home, and they're still using drug and alcohol abuse. It's staggering.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an individual choice, but, I mean, the same thing. I mean, when you find God again, I mean, we came on a Christmas Day in 1970. We took off Christmas Eve, went to church services, and took off for a deliberate bombing mission on a concentration of troops and bombed them to heck in a handbasket, you know, killed them all on Christmas morning. And then as we're flying back, all of a sudden God came to all of us on the flight. But I'll never forget that. But, I mean, God comes into play when you least expect it and you don't know when it's going to happen. And boy, when it lights up, it's kind of wonderful.
Yes, it definitely gives you a sense of purpose. And that's the biggest thing. But, and you know, what I find out, and because, you know, Triple H, yes, is a business, and we, you know, we're building furniture. But what I have found out is, and I explained this to Ray the other night when we were eating dinner, is if you imagine yourself as a triangle, and at the point of the three points of the triangle, you have one point is your mind, one point is your body, and one point is your spirit or your soul. And when you're involved in any sort of trauma, but, you know, we're talking combat trauma here, but it could be car accident, it could be sexual assault. I mean, trauma is trauma, and the brain deals with trauma the same way. But when you're involved in a combat trauma situation, any one of those things can be affected. So the triangle can be broken in all three positions. So the DOD, the Navy, the Army, they do a really good job, and I applaud the Navy, because if not for Navy medicine, I wouldn't be here today. So the Navy is doing a fantastic job on the medical side. But they do a really good job of healing your mind and your body, and good on them for that. But they do nothing for your spirit. And the DOD is not a spiritual organization. I don't blame them. Nobody blames them for not, because that's not what they do. But until you heal your spirit of that moral injury, you will never be healed. So, you know, when the services send these guys out of the services back into society, you know, you're looking at a triangle with a broken point, and that's the spirit. And you send them out into this world with a broken spirit, and he's going to choose the wrong way every time, and he's going to have no direction, and he's never going to heal, and he's going to continue to turn to those things that the world says are the right things. So, you know, for me, when I bring these guys in, a lot of them come in with an attitude of, you know, I'm really not a big fan of God. You know, questions like, what kind of God allows what I saw or had to do to happen? What kind of God allows my friend to die in front of me? You know, where was God in that situation? Well, I had two choices. When I meet these guys, I can take my Bible and I can slap them across the face with it as hard as I possibly can. And what they're going to do is they're going to get in the fight. They're going to go right into the anger, and they're going to go right into that combat mindset and want to fight me. And they would be happy to do that, because most of them, they understand that. So that's not going to work. So the idea for me is to bring them in, gain their trust. They have to build trust in me. They have to build trust in what we're doing and the guys around them. And then we slowly work in the idea of healing through Christ. I have just seen it time and time again where, you know, the worst guys, the most angry guys, the guys that just want to come in and just fight everybody and fight the world, 30, 60, 90 days, 6 months down the road, you know, time is irrelevant. You know, it's an individual thing. You see these guys, you see that light bulb start to come on. You see the understanding in Christ. You see their defenses go down. You see the willingness to accept Christ as part of the healing process. And when that starts to happen, you begin to see this light come back in their eyes, and you see this understanding of, man, you know, there's something bigger out there for me. And you know, the idea God never chooses perfect people, because if he did, you wouldn't choose anybody because there's nobody perfect. The idea of, you know what, God takes brokenness and makes beauty out of ashes. I mean, we're all ashes. We come back completely burnt up into ashes. And for him to take, you know, in my case, for him to take the garbage that I went through for so many years in combat and to turn it into this beautiful thing and this blessing thing and this thing that's just making the world a better place is amazing. You know, and had I not chosen him, I would have just been, you know, number 22 for that day that, you know, committed suicide. And my daughter would have grown up without a father, and my wife wouldn't have had a husband. And, you know, no telling the horrible aftermath of, you know, me choosing suicide. But now look at the beauty he's creating through it. It's mind-blowing to me as I think about it every single day.
I mean, God was a carpenter, and he molds our soul, and he molds more than that, and then he molds, and that allows you guys to mold with your hands. I mean, the analogy is just, it's beautiful.
Yeah, but one of our verses, Bible verses that we go to, are, you know, that's really a part of who we are, is Nehemiah 2:18, where, you know, God tells them, strengthen your hands and build the wall back, you know. And so, you know, that's what I try to start with these guys, man. God is telling you, strengthen your hands and let's build something. Let's build our lives back. Let's build our spirit back. Let's build something for somebody so that, you know, they're not taking the same path that we're taking in their lives, you know, through whatever trauma they might be suffering from.
Well, you know, let me say something, too, about Doug. Doug had become a very good friend of mine. I admire Doug. He's a champion for warriors. But Doug participated in some of the, you know, defending our nation. And sometimes defense has to do with destroying the enemy. And I said in my book, The Neverending War, I said something about, we didn't realize this but when we were doing it, but whenever we took a life of someone, a little bit of us died with them. And I think it's a spiritual thing when that happens with all of us. If you have any conscience whatsoever, when you take another man's life, then a little bit of your kind of light goes out too. And so you come back home and you deal with this thing. Doug is he just blows me away with some of the crafts that he does. He's in arts, he's in gardening, he's in building, he's in this and that. And last week we had an astronomer on there, and they were talking about the, you know, the stars and all the planets and everything. And I was listening, and my mind went back to those jungles out there. Many times you'd be looking, because we were lived out there all the time, it seemed like, and you would look up at a starlit sky and the moon and all this up there, and it would look so peaceful as far as that goes, and it was a different world from what we were living in. And I think when we come back, we seek out things that are peaceful or give us some kind of accomplished feelings of accomplishment. And Doug, it just blows me away sometimes when you get to talking to this guy and he begins to tell you all that he does. And I think it's common with all of us. I don't know if it's done any help at all, but I do know that my book is sold to hundreds of people working in the VA, psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists, because they told me so. And I don't think it was very many years ago, and I know the last 2.5 years when my book has been selling, that I dealt with post-traumatic stress, but I dealt with moral injury. I didn't even realize some of this, but that I was writing in there. And they've come back to me, and they began to use a lot more moral injury in the military now than what they had before. I know the Marine Corps because I'm at Camp Lejeune, and right now they've invited me to teach a class on moral injury to these troops coming back. And I think they have recognized the fact that there's a part of us that needs to be dealt with, because we've been injured. And like you said, Roy, it could be anybody who's ever been traumatized, that life-threatening experience, because it has a tendency to shut you down and you're afraid to move forward. And then it always digresses into substance use and abuse, trying to make yourself feel better. And then it just creates a larger problem. And it takes a moral healing because you have been injured. And we have to understand God is the only one who can heal that. And mm-hmm. I know for me, through Jesus Christ, I became a healed person. I don't I don't feel the guilt that I once felt, even though I know what I did was wrong, but God has a way of healing you, and you become a whole person, and you're able to move through life. Now, you will never get over it. You'll always regret it, but you don't have to have that burden upon you all the time of feeling like you've done all this wrong and there's no resolve, because through God, he can fix you that healing that we need. So I'm glad he's touched all of our lives that way.
Roy, when you start working the building and the kids come in, have they had any experience with carpentry? Are you starting from the beginning to teach them how to use a hammer, a saw, a drill, a plane? Where are we at, and what do you find?
Yeah, I find that I get a bigger group that has no experience at all than I do a group that knows anything. So a lot of times it's just starting right from the basics. And, you know, these guys are intimidated. And it's funny because we kid on a lot of guys, you know, and we tell them, like, man, you can take a 50 caliber machine gun and take it apart and put it back together and employ it, you know, in a matter of seconds. And you don't know how to operate a chop saw or a miter saw or a table saw, you know, so it's funny. But, yeah, they come in, you know, they're kind of like, oh, I don't know about this. And we start them off slow, and we kind of let them jump in, you know, and get in as much as they want to get in. And a lot of times it's not about the idea of I'm nervous around the tools or anything like that. It's I'm nervous that I don't know if I can do this. And so we have to, and it's, I don't know if I can do this because I'm dealing with so much. I don't know if I want to add anything else, and I don't trust these guys, and I'm just not sure what's going on here. And so we gotta really kind of build trust in them. And a lot of times it is just like, you know, they gain confidence in themselves through learning how to operate the tools or whatever. And then they gain confidence in us because weeks go by or days or months or whatever, and, you know, we're constantly proving to them that this isn't about me. It's not really even about you. It's about God. And let's just, if we all continue to keep our eyes on God, then, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to be a good thing no matter what because, you know, he makes all things good. So, you know, it is what it is as far as experience level goes. And another thing I try to tell these guys is, don't be scared to take a piece of wood and cut it wrong or make a backwards cut on it or cut it too short or whatever. Because guess what? In combat, when you pulled that trigger, there was no taking the bullet back, and I get that. But here, guess what, man? I got a whole wall full of wood over there, and if you cut a wrong board, we just grab another board. It's not that big a deal, and we'll just keep going. And guess what? That one you cut wrong, the next project, we're probably going to use it in another place at another time for another thing. So it's not a big deal. And they handle that well in that, you know what, I can't really make a mistake here. You know, and we all know in combat, especially today, I remember having such a time with my guys and trying to get them to understand the constant changing rules of engagement. From day to day, the rules would change, and the rules would change, and the rules would change. And these kids, you know, they're 17, 18 years old. They're in a turret of a armored vehicle sitting behind a 50 caliber machine gun or a grenade launcher or something that, you know, one pull of the trigger is going to send 30, 40 rounds, you know, towards something or somebody, and there's no taking that back. So, and if he's constantly being told, like, okay, well, today it's not okay for them to integrate into your convoys with privately owned vehicles. Well, tomorrow, it's okay. Well, then the next day, it's not okay. You know, so it's so hard for these kids to wrap their minds around when is it okay to pull this trigger and when is it not. And 10 times out of 10, you got about a half a second to make that decision to pull the trigger or not. And, you know, to levy that on the backs of an 18-year-old kid, oh man, that's just an immense amount of pressure. And then to add on to that, I didn't pull the trigger because I was unsure, and in the aftermath, my buddy got killed. So is it my fault that he got killed? Now I'm carrying that guilt. And, man, it's just such an immense amount of pressure to put on these young kids. And hey, I say young kids, but you know what? That's an immense amount of pressure to put on anybody at any age.
You know, I think part of the problem, and we've talked about this, we've ran into it, I mean, the educational level of most in the military today is pretty poor. They maybe came out of high school. There have been some officers came out of college. Maybe some enlisted have been out of the end of the unit, college, university life. But overall, their educational level is so poor. A lot of them are escaping from nightmares to begin with and walking into another nightmare. So their psychological development, their educational development, their family structure development, I mean, it's completely different. I mean, when I went to Vietnam, and again, when I went to Desert Storm, my dad had been at Pearl Harbor and Wake Island and all that stuff, and all this stuff came back. But I know when I'm going again, Dad, oh, hello, you're doing what? You know, and then I'm going again, Dad. So, I mean, you know, three times in my life while there where I was gone again, I don't even know where to put it. How when you're not prepared and you don't have the family support, family structure network back there for a support system, are you supposed to recover when you come back from this world back in the Disney World?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I don't know. And we are discovering that answer every day right here. And, you know, I tell these guys that when they come here and they become a part of our call it our family, because my wife is a big part of this thing too, and that I would venture to say that most of the time the spouses of service members experience as much PTSD as a result of the choices that the Marine or soldier makes as a result of his combat trauma as the Marine does, you know. So she's got her own level of PTSD that she's dealing with, and she's got her own level of misunderstanding about what PTSD is, and she's trying to deal with this husband that she doesn't understand it. His emotions are all over the place and the decisions that he's making, and she's trying to understand what this thing is. And you know, again, he's an 18, 19, 20-year-old Marine, and she's an 18-year-old, 19-year-old wife of a Marine, and 9 times out of 10, now a mother. And so she's juggling motherhood, being a wife, and dealing with this huge thing that her husband's dealing with. And so we discovered that, you know what, I could do all I can do for the Marines and soldiers that I'm dealing with in the shop, but if their wives aren't getting some level of healing as well, then it's not going to work. And so my wife does a lot of work with their wives. And she is very good. She's a school teacher, so she's very good at explaining things. And she's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful woman. And I always say that thank God that he blessed her with endless grace, because if not for her endless grace, I wouldn't be a married man today. And I thank God for giving me her. And I probably wouldn't be alive today. So I attribute my life to her. And what we're doing a lot to her and her strength. But we tell the couples or the individual Marines and soldiers that, hey, you know, when you join this, you're not just coming here and you're going to be here for a couple of weeks and, you know, you're going to go away and we're going to give you some magical spell and you're going to be healed from PTSD and you're going to go live your life. We let them know that, guess what, man, we do not have the answer. PTSD is a lifelong battle. You know, you learn what your triggers are, you learn what works for you, and you learn what your new normal is. You never go back to that person that you were post-combat. I mean, I'm sorry, pre-combat. You're a new person, and you have a new normal. Your new normal might mean I can't walk into a Walmart without having a panic attack. Your new normal might mean I can't go to a kid's birthday party and be around a bunch of kids yelling and screaming away. You name it. For every Marine or soldier or sailor that has combat trauma in his past, there's a trigger out there that triggers that individual, a smell or a sight or a sound or anything like that. So we tell them, you need to identify that, you need to acknowledge it, and then compensate for it, and then you have a new normal. But when you're a part of our family, guess what? I'm going to be calling you on the phone. I'm going to be text messaging you. I'm going to be emailing you. And when, you know, right now I'm 39 years old. When I'm, if God allows me to live on this earth until I'm 80 years old, awesome. At 80 years old, I'm going to be calling you because we're both going to still be on this path. And if, and I'm not sitting here telling you that I'm completely healed. And I tell them, I'm only a few steps above you. Ray, Doug, you guys are a few steps, you know, in front of me. So I'm learning from you. And then I'm gaining knowledge and I'm gaining understanding and I'm passing it on to the guys behind me. And I tell them, there's going to be a time in your healing process that there's going to be a guy that walks through this door that's two steps behind you. And you have to be ready to grab that guy and give him what I'm giving you. And we pass it on and we pass it on and we pass it on. And we just keep building this thing. And we, you know, I tell all the guys, man, I'm, you know, I was only a company commander when I got out of the Marine Corps, so I never commanded a battalion. But you know, I'm building my little PTSD battalion over here, and we're gonna conquer the world, I hope, or at least conquer PTSD. And so that's the bigger picture of what we're trying to do with these guys is that, you know, don't look for the quick fix, don't look for the pills, don't look. Let's look long term, and let's look at a first Jesus Christ-centered healing process, and then let's look at a whole life healing process as we move forward.
You know, the headline...
Boy, one thing I do talk to them about is to keep your head straight. We had to do it in combat, and today our war has changed, our enemy has changed. Today it's drugs, it's alcohol. We have to keep our head straight if we're going to be forward. But one thing I can hear, your voice and Doug's also, and I know with me, and they say it's a big deal today, is that a lot of people come back from military, and they had a lot of camaraderie. They were with people they could associate with. They could understand each other's problems. They were working together as a team. And, you know, in combat, you've got to have camaraderie. But when they come back home, they lose it because everybody spreads out all over the country. And now they're by themselves, and they have that lack of support and camaraderie. And they don't feel secure like they did before. And so they have to kind of come up with their own plan. But a lot of times, when something like what you're doing, with gathering these guys together, and you're an officer, and Doug was an officer. I was a peon. But, you know, you understand, and I was a squad leader, so I understand a little bit. You have to keep that camaraderie, and that is what holds these guys together. They can identify with what you're telling them, where most people they don't identify with. One of the things I found out when I wrote my book, and it's a little bit more of a story, I won't go into that, but I found out early on that I had to write about a lot of issues I didn't want to write about, like fear and the anger and those things like that we hide from everybody. But I had to reach real deep down inside of me and bring those things out, not wondering wondering if somebody's going to think I'm a wimp or something. But I knew that if I didn't deal with those deep down issues that I was dealing with, the lack of security, the fear, the anger, that I wouldn't be able to touch the guys who were hurting. And through doing that, you're able to touch a lot of people because that's where they're hurting the most, and they don't come out and tell everybody. So doing what you're doing and doing what Doug does and what I'm trying to do is we're able to reach a lot of veterans because we're able to understand that camaraderie and understand that they're hurting way down deep inside where nobody sees but them. And I'm glad you're capitalizing on that, Roy. And I admire you for what you're doing.
Well, story in Brand New Army Times just came in the mail today. And the highlight is women prepare for combat jobs. 180 female soldiers going into hard combat jobs. How is this going to affect us? What's going to happen? I know in the medical, I was, with females, and I'd just as soon be around them as I would half a dozen other guys that I know. But what happens when we get the females into the frontline combat unit? I mean, as an infantry scout, or on an Abrams, or on a Bradley, or up there in Huey as a door gunner, how is this all going to work? A Blackhawk today, I guess, I'm showing my age. How is this all going to come about? What's going to happen? I mean, we're all raised to look at a female as one thing and to protect a female as one thing, and that doesn't mean they're not capable because I know they're totally capable. But what do we do with the attitudes of the soldiers towards the females and what they have? But then the other frightening thing is, and I saw this in Iraq, female soldiers ain't liked at all by foreign nations. And, I mean, when they see this, we're talking about big-time problems. Where are we going, and what can we do, and how do we bring those back? I mean, they're going to go over with totally different expectations, completely different outlook on life, come back completely different understanding and comprehension of what they went through, and yet their soul and their in-depth thing, whether the three corners of a triangle as you described, Roy, they're going to be all three broken.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I've actually, we talk about females in combat and you know, being in infantry-type jobs or on tanks and stuff like that. The funny thing is I have experienced some level of females in combat in that in 2009, I took a company of military police officers over, and our mission was convoy security and route clearance and things like that. And a lot of the vehicle drivers and stuff like that were females. And, you know, in the midst of the fight, I mean, they were there. They were in the truck. They were driving the trucks. They were part of it. And I think I told you this story one time, Ray, but here's a quick funny story about, you know, that I always tell when I have to talk about females in combat. We were running a convoy one time, and we had something like 40 trucks, and we knew it was going to be days before we, you know, accomplished our mission. And we had a fuel truck with us, and the fuel truck driver was a female Lance Corporal, young. She was probably 19 or 20 years old. And what we would do when the convoy would, you know, we needed fuel in the trucks, is we would take her truck and pull it over and let the convoy kind of pass her by, and she would fuel the trucks as they came by. And that worked out great. And one time we were fueling and got into a little bit of a scuffle, and rounds were going off. And my vehicle, being the commander there, my vehicle was very close to the fuel vehicle because that's the center of activity. So my first thought was, to be completely honest, and maybe this makes me a horrible person, but you know, we're in a black and white world in combat, was I couldn't care less whether she was a female or a male. All I cared about was I need to make sure that fuel is still moving into these vehicles, firefight or not. We need to still be fueling vehicles. And so I ran around my vehicle around her, you know, to see what was going on in between the trucks. And what I discovered was this little, you know, 120-pound female Marine with all her combat gear on and Kevlar and everything on, and she's got one hand on the fuel nozzle pumping into a truck, and she's got her M4 on her hip in the other hand, sending rounds downrange. And it was you know, in that moment, it was just like there's no way she hit anything, you know, that those rounds were going. But buddy, she was in the fight. And you know, my immediate thing was like, you know, are you okay? Not that because you're a female, but are you okay? Is fuel still moving into these vehicles? And she said, you know, at the top of her voice, in the midst of the madness, like, don't worry about it, sir, I got it. And she's just pulling that trigger. I'm like, all right, you got it. And you know, we got fueled up and we moved on from that. But I would not say I'm the biggest advocate for females in serious frontline combat positions, because there are some emotional things that men go through in reference to women. And to be completely honest, I just think having women, you know, in any environment, when you got a bunch of young men around, obviously they're distracted. And you can give young Marines and soldiers every class in the world and tell them every punishment there is, you know, in reference to, having sexual contact with a female in a combat situation or sexual assault or any number of those things. You can give them a million hours of training on what it means not to do those things. And you know what? A young man of 18 to 20 years old, he's got about one thing on his mind. And that's just the reality of the world that we live in. And so that constant distraction of having females mixed in there, I just don't understand why we would create a distraction for ourselves.
Can I say one thing about in the 1967 war with Israel, they found out three things about putting females in combat along with males. And whether you're in a fighting hole or a bunker or a vehicle or whatever, you had three or four men and you have a female, for instance. And they said there were three things that they found happened all the time. So the first one is you've got males, and there's always at least one male that wants to fall in love with her because she's pretty. She looks prettier than everybody else. There's a thing there, a chemical thing between a male and a physiological thing, but somebody's going to fall in love with her. And sometimes there will be two of them, and so you end up with this jealousy deal, and a little bit of you break down the camaraderie. They said the second thing is, because it's a natural thing that men do, they want to help her. It's like the big brother kind of thing and the sister of where you want to help them do stuff. You want to carry stuff for them. It's just a natural thing that men have about them. And they said the third thing happens when you have a woman in combat, the Israelis found out, is that, especially in the Middle East, when your enemy finds out you have women on the front line, they will fight you 10 times harder to keep from being whipped by a woman, because they don't like women over there. And so we have a whole different mentality over here in the United States. When we send our women over there to the Middle East, we're sending them into double trouble. And so we need to think about those things before we put that through our troops. We need all the camaraderie we can, and we don't need distractions. And those women can fight, they can serve, they're good at what they do, they're good in every field, really. But there's certain things that you're not going to put a woman in because it just breaks down the power of those men fighting.
What do we do for hygiene? I mean, the problem I ran into, I mean, I was so lucky during Vietnam I was flying, so I literally go and fly my mission, come back, go to a hooch where I had hot water, cold water, a half decent bed, you know, clean sheets to get into, and then, you know, a few hours later, then we're back on another mission. But then we went to Desert Storm and lived in the desert. I went for 3 months without seeing an honest-to-God real toilet, much less a real shower. You know, and we were bathing on starlighters or bathing out of our helmets or buckets. I mean, they modified the helmet instead of the old steel pot where you could take it out and use it as a wash pan. Now you can't do that anymore. It's got electronics and everything else on it. What do we do for hygiene? How do we take care of everything? How do we, when we're going to sleep and you're sleeping, Ray, you can explain this. I mean, you slept in a mud hole most of your life.
I did. That's true. And I said in my book, and I really mean this, and I'm probably, it may not be as many as I say in the book, but I don't remember taking more than 6 showers in Vietnam in 1969 because we lived in the jungle 85 to 90% of the time. And so you would go a month, 2 months sometimes without changing clothes. Or, you know, we laid on the ground. We didn't have tents. The Marine Corps liked to pack light so they can fight. That's their philosophy or something. But, you know, we didn't have tents or sleeping bags or a mattress to lay on. We laid on the dirt. We pulled this little blanket over us. We used our pack for a pillow. And that's basically what life was about, you know. And when you're 18 and 19, you want to take a shower anyway. There were no girls. So we didn't care. You know, it didn't matter. But you smell horrendous. But the idea out there in where I lived at, if you didn't smell like dirt, you would get yourself ambushed. And so it was a life and death situation. A lot of people cannot take that kind of filth. And sometimes you have to put up with it.
Well, and I'll tell you, to add one more piece to that, that same deployment, you know, in 2009, I think out of 135 Marines, and I had 6 corpsmen, but they're Marines for all intents and purposes. I had, I don't know the exact number. I probably had 5 females, and about 2 months into that deployment, we found out one of the females was pregnant. So now I have a situation where obviously she cannot remain in a combat environment pregnant, so she had to be returned back to Camp Lejeune. And I did not get a combat replacement for her. So now I'm a Marine down for the rest of deployment because, you know, she got pregnant. So that's a whole other piece that I looked at as a commander, like, wow, yeah, I could really use every, you know, I could have used 100 more Marines, but to go out with 135 and then lose one was not good. It never is good.
We're about running out of time. Roy, how do they get in touch with you? Where are you at? Fill us all that information in here in the last 4 or 5 minutes.
Okay, yeah, we currently operate out of Jacksonville, North Carolina, right outside of Catlett's Jean, North Carolina. And you can go to our website. It's www.triplehcarpentry.com, or you can find us on Facebook under Triple H Carpentry. And I won't give out any emails or phone numbers over the air, but if you go to my website, our phone numbers and email addresses are there, and we'd love to. You know, anybody who wants any information or wants any furniture or any Marines or soldiers or sailors or airmen out there that would love to come and be a part of what we're doing, we'd love for you to come and gain some healing with us.
You know, it's kind of unique. When I went to Marine Corps OCS back in 74, the Marines were leading then, and now you're a retired Marine and you're still leading, Roy. That's, God bless you. Thank you.
I learned it from you guys.
Ray, what do you think in the end here? I mean, a lot of stuff happening in the world right now, a lot of memories being brought up, a lot of healing that needs to be done. At the same time, things are broken. What do we do again?
You know,
it comes back
just,
to individual choices?
Yeah, that's true. Individual choices, you're right. I mean, I always tell them the only difference between me and the people I admire are the choices I make, and that's where it comes down to. You have to choose to get better. You have to choose to do what you have to do, and for your family, your children.
Well, thank you very much. God bless you, Captain Roy. Thank you there, Ray. And have a good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Again, healing through carpentry. Thank you, Roy.
Thanks.
Thank you, Roy.